Hello. For our regular ASI cast listeners who've been following the episodes this year and who've reviewed the agenda for the 2025 TV, television, and video conference, you'll know that the latest trends in the viewer journey are certainly in the spotlight during the content and distribution session this year. Now, making sense of the user journey as content owners and distributors seek to reach and monetize across platforms continues to bring us to questions as to whether collaboration and competition can truly live in harmony. Well, with that in mind, welcome to ASI Cast number 193. I'm your host, John McCarthy, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Natasha Haritskuk, who's the VP and Head of Corporate Research at Warner Brothers Discovery, to help us unpack that question and listen and learn about some of the latest research that Warner Brothers Discovery have been up to. So, with that long intro, welcome, Natasha.
Thanks, John. Glad to
And
be here.
thanks for dialing in from New York. Now,
No problem.
you lead, as I said, corporate research at Warner Brothers Discovery. What does that actually involve?
Well, it's kind of interesting you should ask because we created the inaugural corporate research team about 2 years ago. And there had been other sort of variants of it, but they kind of made us a lean, mean, small team and said, look, we're a federated company, meaning the business units have their own research organizations. So our mission was to identify a research agenda or a research plan that was going to be additive to the business units' knowledge base. But be completely incremental. And what we realized pretty quickly was that the business units, like I think, in most companies, they're dealing with the day-to-day. They're reviewing, they're testing scripts, they're testing trailers, they're testing marketing, they're tracking brands, they're doing product assessments or UI assessments, in the case of HBO Max, they're doing a lot of measuring, tracking, and evaluating. But what they don't necessarily have time to do, we realize kind of falls into two buckets. One, how do we look at our current assets and the current ecosystem and optimize the consumer experiences given the realities today? And then the second piece that we're focused on is, if we peek around the corner, even into the next year to 5 years, what should we be anticipating from a consumer perspective? So those are really the two big buckets that we focus on as a corporate research team.
Okay, well, with that in mind then, and given we're in the fourth quarter of the 2025, you've obviously got a unique macro view of the industry. What's the biggest game changer you've seen to rise to the fore in 2025?
I mean, two. I'll maybe address the one that I just feel like the minute you say this acronym, everybody immediately gets a bored look on their face. But I'll start off with short form, which has obviously been a passion project for us. I think what has really, there have been two major developments, I think, over the past few years. One, very positively for studios like ours, we've discovered that short form is actually a very strong and additive companion to TV shows and movies. That short form, our fear was it was a zero-sum game. People are watching short form, therefore they're not watching our stuff. And what we found is that actually there's two very discrete usage occasions. When people are watching short form, there's a specific set of needs that are driving that occasion. When people are watching TV shows and movies, there's a completely different, discrete set of needs that are driving the decision to engage with those platforms. Two, that short form has become the predominant vehicle for discovering new TV shows and movies, or at least new to the viewer TV shows and movies. And thirdly, the nature of certainly, I think like with HBO Max, we tend to release on a weekly cycle. There are gaps between seasons. When you think about the theatrical business, you're not just like, the minute one movie gets released, another movie's like being released the next day. There are gaps, particularly between franchise releases like Superman. And how do you keep fans engaged when you've got a year or 2 years in between seasons or franchise theatrical releases? Short form again. Short form's proven to be a really vital platform for keeping viewers engaged and creating a lot of ancillary content that's often fan created as well as increasingly created by us that keeps people kind of sated, you know, that they're not just sort of getting a 2-year break, but they're continuing to engage with our IP in between releases. So I think those have been three really positive developments from our perspective. The second thing I was going to say was AI, but you know, I think it's just such a massive topic, and it feels like every conference and every webinar seems to be devoted to AI. And I feel like short form is as big from a marketing and engagement perspective, but it doesn't get talked about as much. Maybe it's getting
Sure.
talked about a little bit more.
I mean, to a certain degree, you talked about discoverability, and I suppose AI is helping in that in or hindering in that regard, depending on how you're prepared to look at it.
What we actually found, because we did do a study on AI and consumers' expectations around AI as it intersects with entertainment, and it was really interesting. But AI is currently the fourth primary platform for content discovery. It'll move up. It'll move up, and AI will be generating the, you know, driving algorithms and driving the content in in the short form environment. So it'll get kind of conflated over time.
Well, we look forward to seeing that progressing, and hopefully we'll have
Yeah, I
another
think
we
we all
can we have
do.
that for another episode. But turning to you were talking about short form more generally, broadcasters and media groups like Warner Brothers Discovery leveraging other platforms. Now, Warner Brothers Discovery have been around for a very, very long time, very successful business. But of course, there are others that you mentioned there. Now, YouTube has turned 20 this year, as we know, and TikTok will turn 10 next year. Now, obviously, in the years since their arrival in the last 10 and 20 years, respectively, many have initially felt that they represent a threat, as you said, seizing audiences away from long form to short form. Now, you've been actually doing some research around this, so maybe we could just unpack that a bit more. How did the project first itself, why did Warner Brothers Discovery set out to run this project?
So we had done a study. I sort of there was sort of a funny little pause there because I think this is like a classic scenario for so many researchers where you stick to your guns despite the fact that you're being told that we're not interested. And that was really how this project started. So we were doing a study. We had been doing a study yearly for almost, you know, as long as I've been at the company, so at least 10 years, where we it's a share of time study. So you look at how people are allocating their time across different entertainment platforms. And what we'd been noticing year on year is that social video viewing, as discrete from social media, like we kind of separate the two. We see social media as more text-based, like Reddit, like X, like Snapchat, versus more video-based, like TikTok and YouTube. And we were really focused on the latter because it mimics, you know, it mimics the TV and movie experience, but in shorter bursts. And what we were seeing was just this like incremental kind of bump up year on year of short form viewing. And I think the second thing that really struck us was it wasn't just younger generations. Older generations were starting to watch more and more short form. And we sort of thought, okay, we can't really ignore this. I mean, yes, we're not in the short form business. No, we probably won't be in the short form business anytime soon, but we should at least understand these dynamics. And we started off by looking at short form usage amongst Gen Zs and millennials specifically, and then we did Xs and boomers. So when I kind of presented this research, I think, you know, the general view here was Quibi got brought up again. And it's like, well, that was a long time ago. That was pre-pandemic. And, you know, there were platform issues. There was, you know, the financials didn't work out. Like, it's a very different world. As you've said, TikTok is now 10 years old. YouTube's 20 years old. Like, it's not, you know, the world has kind of moved on and these have become institutionalized. But I think the way the business was reading it was, we're never going to create short form. So why should we do a deep dive into short form? But we set out to just understand the dynamics. Like, was it either or? Was it a zero-sum game? What were the needs, or what was the rationale, the occasions, the sort of psychological drivers behind short form viewing versus long form viewing? Were they discrete? Were they overlapping? Was there actually a threat? Was there not a threat? So we were kind of going in from a very exploratory perspective to understand what was underlying this, cable becoming this big, streaming like SVOD viewing, kind of like this, and then short form starting to really kind of get, short form was kind of approaching or becoming even more of a focal point of the viewer's day. So that's really what kicked the study off.
Okay, great. Well, we maybe unpack some of the specific findings and results. But before we do that, a large number of our ASI cast listeners are research practitioners. So could you just give us a quick insight or headlines into the methodology and the approach you took?
We tend to because we are corporate research and we're sort of meant to be approaching things a little bit differently. We always kind of pull the tools together for each project in a bespoke fashion. In this case, and I mean, this isn't like we weren't doing anything, we weren't breaking the boundaries of research. We started off with ethnographies and then focus groups. But we always like to do ethnography just because with focus groups, especially when you're doing younger audiences like Z's and millennials are older now, so it's less of an issue. But sometimes the differences get a little ironed out. So what we normally do is we start off with ethnography so we can get the depth and the texture and really understand, okay, what's going on, what's really going on behind the scenes here. And then we will sometimes do friendship pairs or triads or focus groups just to kind of start to understand and framework out like patterns, basically. And then we will take whatever the frameworks are that have emerged or early stage hypotheses and then basically validate them and understand the scale of what we're observing with quant. So that's what we did here.
Okay.
Sometimes we'll do diaries as well. Like Share of Time is a little bit more of a diary thing. But in this case, what we really wanted to get into were the motivations, the psychological drivers behind the decision to watch YouTube, TikTok versus, watch, White Lotus on HBO Max, for example.
Perfect segue then. So tell me, what's your research found? What role do platforms like YouTube and TikTok play in the for Warner Brothers Discovery, for your content, and maybe more generally in the viewing experience?
I mean, a really vital role. So first of all, we found that there were actually very discrete usage occasions between short form viewing and long form viewing. Short form viewing happens primarily during the day. It's when there's kind of spare moments or the brain is sort of like in a lean back mode, like people are kind of switching off, and it's a bit more of a passive activity. They're kind of scrolling, they're letting the content wash over them. They may be pausing and picking up the odd thing, but it tends to be a little bit more disengaged, and it's to kind of wind down and relax. Recent research actually that we've done increasingly started to refer to it as, we've seen this kind of wave of younger consumers starting to refer to it as kind of brain rot. We've heard the term brain rot, that it's, even though there's kind of a dopamine hit, increasingly it feels a little bit like they're bad calories, like they're spending so much time doing it. And at the end of it, they don't necessarily feel nourished. Hopefully they feel at least a little relaxed and a little engaged, which I do think I do think that there are, softer elements of that. Now, separately, when these younger generations, so Z's and millennials, choose to watch a TV show or movie, it becomes like appointment viewing for them. So they are very deliberate. They carve out time in the evening from like 7 till 9 or 8 till 10. I'm watching my show. They are very sort of protective of that time. They actually put their phones away. They're very focused. They're very engaged. And they tend to binge watch. So we call them serial monogamists because, unlike X's and boomers, where you might have five shows on the go and you're kind of watching them intermittently, This is very deliberate. Like, I am now watching Vampire Diaries. They love library content. There's like a huge movement to watching older shows because with younger generations, even if it's an old show, it's new to them. If they haven't seen it before, then as far as they're concerned, it's a fresh view. Let's say Vampire Diaries, they'll say, okay, at 8 o'clock, I'm gonna put on my streaming service, and for the next 2 hours, I'm gonna binge Vampire Diaries. And it's this kind of dedicated time. And the reason why I think the library content is appealing in that scenario is because you've got multiple seasons and they're all available to view at once. So if your intent is to kind of, move away from this kind of more sort of, a little bit more of a passive viewing session, you've been doing this kind of short form viewing on and off throughout the day, and now you're going to really dig in and focus on a TV show, you don't want there to be five episodes. Because that would seem kind of unsatisfactory. They want to be able to really, spend the next month appointment viewing and really digging into and binge watching a show. And so, in their mind, these are, in the consumer's mind, these are the good calories that count in their media diet that kind of start to counteract the bad calories of excessive short form viewing. And again, not all short form viewing are bad calories. It's just that they're doing it so much that they feel like it's kind of sucking up a lot of their time, and they need to counterbalance it. And the long form, ironically, is how, the TV shows and movies are the counterbalance. And it's kind of funny because as a Gen X, when I was growing up, TV was considered, generally was considered bad calories. Like, you've been watching TV for 3 hours, get out of the house, like go do something else. That was considered the passive sort of brain dead activity. So it's kind of funny how things shift generationally.
Oh, totally.
So that was one big finding. And I don't mean to remotely malign short form. It plays a really critical role, I think, in the day of a consumer, but it's just a slightly more disengaged kind of, you're scrolling, the algorithm's doing the work for you. Whereas when you pick a show to watch and you sit down to watch it for an hour or 2 hours, it's more kind of, there's more of an engaged, absorbed viewing session because, by definition, an hour's worth of attention is very different than 10 seconds or 3 minutes or 5 minutes.
Okay, great. I mean, obviously that, as you said, that's one component. The other one is obviously discoverability. I think, as you
Yes,
talked
that's
about at the
huge.
outset, and the role that platforms like YouTube and TikTok play in terms of driving engagement and driving interest. What did your research find from that? Did it apply to any specific, genres or demographics?
No. So this actually, I'm going to now reference a second study we did that was then explicitly, once we saw that there was something going on with short form, we did a second study that was very much digging into short form and the relationship between short form viewing and long form viewing. That was also deep qual, multi-generational, quant, and then we did kind of a zero party data, first party data assessment. So basically, what we wanted to understand is if somebody's been exposed to short form content related to a title, did they go on to view? And so we used a zero party data source, so permission first party data to basically try to prove out that relationship. So to back up what we found, or maybe to move forward, what we found was that younger generations almost exclusively discover. Now, there's word of mouth and other things, but in many instances, so 70 to 75%, it's probably, I think, about 75% of viewers discover the next TV show or movie they're going to watch through platforms like YouTube and TikTok. It may be a meme, it may be a clip, it might be a compilation. Very frequently, it's UGC. So it's fan-created content, which, when you think about it from a marketing perspective, that's about as good as it gets because you're not even paying. Basically, these fans are creating content that we're not paying for. In many instances, they have to pay us if they go over a certain time frame on YouTube. So they're creating content that other consumers see that get consumers interested in watching something, and we haven't had to spend a penny on that. Like, that's pretty magical, really. And UGC is just such a powerful tool. And it's kind of fans speaking to fans without that kind of mediation of the company. But that said, consumers will watch trailers obviously, on YouTube and TikTok, trailer cuts. And increasingly, I know our marketing teams are starting to create bespoke content for these platforms, their own clips, their own compilations, their own reviews, humorous stuff, fun stuff, memeable stuff, shareable stuff. So all of that content in the aggregate is how many younger viewers encounter content for the first time. And they'll kind of build up to the viewing. Like they'll not just see one 10-second clip. They'll start to seek out more, watch more, and they start to build up their anticipation, and then they'll watch. Because there's so much, like once you start watching something, the algorithm will serve up more. And so you can imagine you start to get more, think about a new show coming up for us, like Welcome to Derry. It's starting to really hit TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram Reels. And so once you express interest, you like it, you share it, you'll start to see more and more, and you'll see different diverse clips. You'll start to get to know the characters, so you start to get a little invested. And then when you watch it, it's kind of the consummation of all this anticipation. We thought, okay, this is just younger people. Xers and boomers are not watching these platforms as much. I will say that Xers, a lot of Gen X are starting to increasingly discover new content on these platforms. But what's kind of unique about Gen X and boomers is they, we call what millennials and Zs are doing, and millennials are up to 43 years old, so they're not children anymore. They pregame, they build up interest and anticipation before they view. Xers and boomers are doing a little bit of the pre-gaming, but they're doing more post-gaming. I just watched White Lotus. Then they go to these platforms and start exploring the content. Ooh, Walton Goggins, like I want to learn more about him, or Leslie Bibb, or they start following the talent, or they start following the official accounts. So they do it almost like a post-viewing immersion. And both are interesting, but they both build an emotional connection to the content that's very powerful.
Now, that's great. I mean, just going back then, I think you mentioned about user-generated content, which obviously there's a lot of, and it's driving fan engagement, driving discoverability. But of course, platforms like YouTube also have a huge long tail of long-form
They
content as
do.
well, with a number of networks and media groups using that platform beyond their own streaming service. Now, HBO Max obviously was the most nominated streamer at this year's Emmys, so big congrats for that. I mean, but
I wish I
looking at
could take
YouTube,
credit. I
but
didn't
well, look,
work
but
here.
looking at platform level, does content on other platforms help or hinder you as a media group, as a network?
So having longer form content on YouTube, is that
Yeah, is that a
beneficial
good
or
thing or a
bad?
bad thing? Yeah.
I think it's a good thing because if people are going to be turning to that, if people are going to watch this longer form content on YouTube anyway, then we need to be where the fans are. I think where it's particularly useful is if we have IP that maybe people have forgotten about, or let's say we're, so think about it. We'll use it as an example. It's almost Halloween. Welcome to Derry comes out on Sunday. But when you think about the original It, it's kind of ancient. Like the one with Tim Curry, and even the older one, sorry, the newer one, the re-release is a couple of years old. And so, for some people, they may never have had exposure to the It franchise. And then suddenly, if the content starts appearing on YouTube, it may be the first time that consumers encounter the franchise. So it's kind of building that initial relationship. And even if they're watching, an hour of the original Tim Curry movie, it's almost creating a backstory for them. It's almost like a primer, like they're learning about the franchise and building a relationship with the characters and understanding who Pennywise is, so that when they see that, oh my gosh, there's a new prequel on HBO Max, it kind of builds up the knowledge base that helps to, I think, drive more interest and engagement around the new content that's coming out. So I think for IP that is older IP, it can either reinforce an old, like kind of restoke the fires of an old relationship, build a new relationship, or for people who are just Pennywise fans, maybe it's just kind of, getting yourself geared up and in the mood, like that kind of pre-gaming thing. So I still think, I don't think they're not going to watch Welcome to Derry because they've been watching, it on the other platforms. Now, if we chose to put Welcome to Derry We just wouldn't. I mean, it would be a windowing play, where you would maybe release the first five episodes on HBO Max over the course of 5 weeks, and then maybe you start to put some of those episodes, maybe shortened, like you break them into 15-minute segments and put those on YouTube.
Right. I mean, obviously, you talked there about different windowing strategies, and obviously, using other platforms beyond your own also delivers incremental reach ultimately. How do you think you strike the right balance, in your view, between extending reach and commercializing the IP?
Well, and that's kind of the tough bit, right? Because, in a business that was founded on ad sales and content sales and distribution sales, it's all about monetizing. And YouTube, I mean, TikTok feels very like, how are we going to monetize this? Or we're not making, we're making pennies on the dollar. But I think it's a volume play. Like, you can't just think about it as a single franchise, but you have to think about more as the enterprise's strategy across these platforms, which I think is really critical. So, how do we think about all our franchises, even ones like the Flintstones or Looney Tunes that are not top of mind? How do we maybe breathe new life into these franchises using these platforms? And so then it's a marketing play. So hopefully that pays off over time. You may not get that immediate monetization hit, but by the same token, and I'm trying to remember exactly what the numbers are, and I'm sorry, I can't. But once our IP is on the platform for a certain time threshold, we get paid. So there is actually passive income that comes from these platforms. Not this is more explicitly YouTube. So if a creator pulls in our IP, or we have a certain threshold of content that is on these platforms, at a certain point we get paid for having that content on the platform. It's kind of like the licensing of, like, you're sort of licensing your IP, and you get some sort of monetary benefit. It's not the same as selling like an entire TV series to Netflix, but there's still incremental revenue. So I do think that that's important, but I think you don't want to lose sight of the maybe more like the intangibles, which is that for every person who's never seen this franchise before who gets exposure and is now a fan, that's a longer term value play. And I think that's also really, really critical. And marketing's expensive, and this is a really efficient form of marketing, particularly if you're relying on fan generated content.
Sure. I mean, kind of wrapping up then, what you've unpacked an awful lot there in, from the user perspective, from the commercial perspective, from the IP perspective. But what have the findings from the research actually meant for your business? What have you applied them?
So what this research ultimately did was it nudged, so the business realized that it wasn't this kind of one zero sum game, that two, it wasn't that we had to create short form and, erode the studio's attention on long form. It was to sh sort of shift the thinking away from the fact that we're not producing content for these platforms, that these platforms have become a vital marketing vehicle for us. And once it was clear that, like, no, we're not trying to be Quibi, and we're not creating, series that are explicitly for these platforms, they're meant to be a vehicle for discovery and engagement, then that shifted the thinking. And now the marketing teams, like theatrical marketing, HBO marketing, on the networks, they're really leveraging these platforms to showcase our content. And that was the big shift. And it wasn't that they weren't doing it before, but now there's a lot more clarity around how do we leverage UGC? How do we actually empower fans to create content that is going to be, I guess, in sync with the messaging that we want to be conveyed? Like, you don't want a beloved character, smoking a cigarette or beating, there's like the whole brand safety thing. And I think that was always the worry with UGC. But I think what the business is realizing is that most of the UGC is very additive and engaging and fun, and it's fan to fan. So I think, now there's a big focus on how do we leverage that in a more strategic, mindful way. And so that's also become a really interesting focus. Because before UGC was like the Wild West, and oh my God, what are these people doing? And we've got to stop them from tampering with our brands. And now it's much more of an open mindset, like, wow, these guys are doing actually a great job marketing our brands on our behalf. How do we facilitate? How do we support? How do we reward?
Right. I mean, it's great to hear how the research is supporting those wider efforts as well
Yeah.
outside of
It helped
research.
us turn a corner, I think, psychologically.
Great. I mean, we're recording this ASI cast just a week or two actually ahead of our 2025 conference, which takes as its overall theme measurement in 2030. Now, Warner Brothers Discovery, we know you've got some big plans, a number of new market launches, I know for HBO Max. I suppose just to wrap up then, from your point of view, what's the role of measurement in 2030?
I mean, measurements. I think the problem for our industry is when we went from kind of the Nielsen world of linear to more of a digital world, I feel like we still haven't fully caught up. And now digital doesn't even matter. I mean, digital's not unimportant. And I think there's solutions like when it comes to SVOD and all of that. Now we've got our own first party data. But now, like, consumers are moving faster than us, and now we've got to start to think about the impact of these short form video platforms, and how do we measure those? What are the KPIs? Does this shift our thinking from a marketing perspective? How do we know if something's a success in that ecosystem beyond social listening? Is social listening sufficient? Are there new different metrics we should be thinking about? How, when you're looking at a media plan, do you factor in YouTube and TikTok and linear TV, TV advertising, billboards? Like, it's just getting more crowded and more complex. But then, by the same token, to me, this is so firmly a job for AI. I mean, we've already done some early stage experiments with measurement of branded, like, content on TikTok and YouTube and different platforms using AI. And it's really, I mean, we don't have to do it. It's basically just the robot's doing it. The computer's doing it, in effect. And so it makes measurement so much easier. We don't have to, you're just basically providing the right prompts, and AI is very, very good at identifying the right content, looking for common themes, assessing sentiment, assessing scale of impact, et cetera. So I think by 2030, measurement will be a lot easier for us because it'll be kind of in the hands of the bots, which is where I think it probably should be, since we've had such a long-term struggle with figuring out, currency and that sort of thing. I mean, it's been going on as long as I can remember, this struggle.
Well, the future of currency, the role of artificial intelligence, and the viewer journey—lots there, and lots actually that we'll be picking up and putting in the spotlight in Copenhagen in just a few weeks' time. So, if you're listening to this before Copenhagen, it will be interesting to see how we explore some of these findings further on stage. And if you're listening to this after mid-November, then hopefully you can listen to some subsequent episodes that unpack those findings and the thoughts from our conference even further. Well, Natasha, it just leaves me to thank you very much for your time live
My
from New
pleasure.
York. Thank you for joining us, and we hope to hear more and to see you at ASI conference in the future.
Would
Thanks
love that.
again.
And thanks so much. I'm glad we had a chance to chat a little bit about the research, since I would have loved to have joined you. I think it's going to be an amazing conference. And yes, very much hope I can join in a subsequent year.
Thank you.